I have to go upstairs and record something again, so...
Quiet.
Do not...
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
You're listening to Pandemic, a podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungoyne, and each week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. Sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat. The correspondents and I will be recording this in many cases on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Thursday, February 18th, episode 76. Recorded coronavirus cases in Ireland are approaching 213,000, a rise of about 6,000 since last week. Deaths in that time have risen by over 250. They exceed 4,000 now, standing at 4,082 people who have died with the virus. Around the world, according to the figures of the Johns Hopkins University tracker, around 60,000 people have died since our last episode last week, bringing the total to almost 2.43 million, while recorded cases of the virus have risen by 3 million to over 110 million globally. Now, as vaccinations continue in many countries and developed countries compete on their relative rollout records, this week the WHO's Mike Ryan had some strong words as he received an award from the Irish NGO Trocra.
But for all I have said about existing inequities and historical injustices in health, the world right now, this minute, faces what could be a defining moment for us in addressing the suffering associated with this pandemic. And the equity we now have a choice to demonstrate or not demonstrate by who gets this vaccine. If we stand by and allow frontline health workers and vulnerable people in developing countries to not be vaccinated, while the rich North gets on with vaccinating perfectly healthy young people, then I hope the history books write that down. We have a choice to make. And I say that quite openly and at risk of great criticism. We have a choice to make, and the citizens and the communities of the world must demand that that choice is made on the basis of need, vulnerability and equity, not on the ability to pay.
Today, another NGO, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, released a strongly worded statement of its own, raising concerns that developing countries may not get access to the vaccine that's most effective against local dominant variants. This concern comes after South Africa rejected the Oxford-AstraZeneca jab as the main plank in its programme in favour of Johnson & Johnson's vaccine. The reason? A study of 2,000 people aged 31 showed that the AstraZeneca vaccine wasn't as effective against the South African variant of the virus. The finding now casts further doubt on vaccine supply to less well-off countries, according to MSF. We'll hear from them next.
My name is Claire Waterhouse, and I am the Regional Advocacy Coordinator for MSF in Southern Africa.
I was just reading through your statement, and the tone of it expresses quite a deal of urgency. Let's, I suppose, start with the numbers that were highlighted in the press release. It says 174 million people globally have been vaccinated, but there's a stark contrast pointed out with the number of people who've been vaccinated in Africa as a whole.
Absolutely. We're really worried about this, and we really are calling it out now at this point. We're calling it what it is. It's vaccine inequity. It's vaccine segregation. The number you just mentioned, 174 million, is probably even higher today as developed countries across the world are being able to vaccinate their populations. Some of them have even finished vaccinating their high-risk populations, like healthcare workers, and are able to move on to lower-risk populations. And that just seems incredibly unjust, given the fact that most of Africa has not been able to vaccinate a single person yet, let alone its high-risk populations as a whole, to be able to move on to that.
Now, there was a perception last year that Africa had escaped the worst consequences of COVID-19 and wasn't being as badly affected. There was some opinions offered that perhaps the demographics in Africa, having a younger population, etc., had protected it from the worst effects. From the tone of your statement today, I take it that doesn't hold true anymore.
Well, what we've seen in our region in particular is that South Africa, Zimbabwe, Eswatini, Malawi, Mozambique, we've seen a really brutal second wave coming through. We've seen, for example, in some countries like Zimbabwe, they recorded more cases in January this year than they did in the entire of last year. So I'm not an epidemiologist and I can't definitively say what happened last year versus this year, except that we know that there is now this much more infectious variant spreading through, and that really seems to have impacted. And so we've seen health systems that are already under strain in normal circumstances really, really struggling now. We in South Africa, for example, we've seen not enough HR on the ground in hotspots. We've been involved in the second wave heavily, providing doctors and nurses on the ground. In Zim, for example, we see that there are shortages of beds and oxygen and PPE. So it's been a struggle. And those case numbers are coming down now, and we're very grateful for that. But we are now starting to prepare for what could be a third wave or a third surge. And in our view, it's even more critical to get those vaccines urgently in the region so that we can do our best to mitigate whatever might come from a third wave, particularly because we don't know enough about this variant that seems to be spreading through the region.
And has the prevalence of HIV in the region made what would be normally a less vulnerable cohort of the population in other countries more vulnerable in Southern Africa?
That's a good question. And I think we're still collecting evidence on that. I'm sure that it is playing a role, but it would be difficult for me to say yes or no to that definitively. Certainly, there are many vulnerabilities of the population in this area, and those all play a role, I think, in the way that this variant and COVID in general is spreading.
Right. Well, there are concerns being expressed in South Africa. And if South Africa is worried, and that would be a country which would have the capabilities to deal with at least the worst of a health emergency, it follows then that other countries that don't have the capabilities of South Africa are far less well positioned. I mean, South Africa is in a position to order the Johnson & Johnson vaccine at the moment. Where do other countries stand with the ability to change horses, so to speak, on vaccines?
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. We're very lucky here in South Africa that our government has been able to react quite quickly to this. But most other countries in this region are dependent on the COVAX facility to get many of their vaccines. And what we've seen there, and the COVAX facility is backed by donor states, wealthy nations, big pharmaceutical companies. And we've seen that this mechanism hasn't really worked so far for the region. And that's due to the general systemic failure of access to medicines and now vaccines. But what it ends up as is these countries in our region who desperately need the vaccine are not really able to switch. Also don't know when they're getting a vaccine, what they're getting, how much they're getting definitively from this mechanism. And that's a real problem. We really are urging these wealthier states, big pharmaceutical companies and COVAX itself to take this into account. For us, vaccine equity doesn't just mean enough vaccines now. The situation has changed. It means the right vaccines for the right context or the right, variant that you're seeing at the right price. And all of those things are not being met right now for the region.
And how is COVAX supposed to work? For anyone who's not familiar with it, how is it supposed to work and how is it not working in this case?
Well, COVAX is a facility designed to assist all countries in the world to be able to vaccinate the 20% most vulnerable people in its population. So that goes along with, kind of what the WHO has stated to be as its framework. And we completely agree with that. That's healthcare workers, and then it's high-risk people with specific comorbidities, etc. And the way it was supposed to be working was to be able to provide vaccines at, reasonable supplies, reasonable prices for countries. Well, any country is eligible for COVAX, but it is particularly useful, let's say, for developing countries and for poorer countries. How it's actually working, though, is that COVAX is stuck, essentially, because so many wealthier countries have entered into bilateral agreements with pharmaceutical companies, kind of sucking up all the available supplies of vaccines that would have been potentially available for COVAX, and take it, you know, you've heard the phrase vaccine hoarding, I'm sure, and this is a major issue of what we're seeing. Some developed countries have ordered two or three times the amount they need to vaccinate their populations, and they don't show any sign of being willing to share that overstock or give it to COVAX or anything like that, which leaves COVAX in a tricky position because it's in this flawed structure, and it leaves developing countries across the world with very few options and very little transparency on what exactly is going on. And that is dangerous in times of a global pandemic.
How big a blow is the results of studies in South Africa to the use of Oxford AstraZeneca as a vaccine? Because it was supposed to be ideal in that it was cheap, it was supposed to have been provided at cost price, and the storage issue in particular, it could be stored in normal refrigeration and therefore it would make the rollout of it easier. In the absence of that, does it present big problems because of the absence of, say, deep freeze infrastructure and the large distances that might have to be travelled in states where there might be, you know, not a lot of infrastructure between population centres for the storage of these vaccines?
Yeah, that is definitely a concern in some countries, how to store the vaccines, you know, which one is easiest to store and how to do that. I think, so yes, every change that happens, every sort of unpredictable thing, the latest being these lower efficacy findings that you mentioned, is of course a setback because it involves having to reevaluate, reassess what can work, how it can work. It involves countries having to take a fresh look at how they're going to do this. But, you know, for so many countries at the moment on the continent, this is a hypothetical discussion because until we know what vaccine they can get and how they can get it, they can't really be, you know, dealing with those practicalities. So really the most urgent thing is to be getting vaccines and then from there having to deal with those practicalities about how we can make it work.
And what about lab infrastructure? Because you said in your statement that you want the right vaccines for the right variants in different countries. How well developed would the lab infrastructure be in order to find out what variants are at play, where they're at play, and what vaccines would be needed in that case?
That is an interesting question. And certainly there is obviously a need for countries to be able to do the genome sequencing required to be assessing what variants they are. From our understanding, obviously, there's many countries that are not really able to do this, not just on the continent. I think actually South Africa was quite far ahead of its time in being able to identify a variant that had broken out so quickly. So I would say that's important globally for everyone to be paying attention to. It is, of course, a real concern in Africa as well, but it is also a global concern. We're not likely to see less variants coming through, just more.
And on the intellectual property front, you have a particular bone to pick. Is it with Europe and the United States, or is it Europe in particular on the issue of intellectual property and vaccines and how it provides a blockage to the widespread proliferation of vaccines?
It's with any countries, in fact, that are blocking a waiver request that has come through. It's essentially, this is a request that South Africa and India are leading to the World Trade Organization to waive intellectual property rights on specific COVID tools, which would include, you know, medicines and vaccines. And they're asking for a temporary waiver on these intellectual property rights to enable them to then be able to get alternative supplies or locally manufacture. Essentially, it would bring down many of the barriers to trying to access what is needed to fight COVID. And most of the developing world has backed this waiver, but we are seeing, again, wealthy states like the EU, the US, Canada, Australia, Japan, blocking this waiver, just full stop blocking it at the level of the World Trade Organization. And that, to be honest, seems absolutely ridiculous to us. It's literally putting profits over people's lives, and we really are pushing hard that these countries reconsider their position on this and consider supporting this waiver. We're in an extraordinary pandemic, and that requires extraordinary actions at the moment.
And what is the ostensible reason that you've heard for not agreeing to this waiver? Is it as baldly stated as profits are more important and the interests of the company and their shareholders need to be protected? Or is there some other ostensible reason given for it?
From what we have been able to understand, it is much the same reason that is always given to protect intellectual property, particularly around medicines, and that is to protect innovation and to protect these large companies that have spent a lot of time and money investing in these technologies. But there's a flaw in that argument, because most of that technology, particularly with these vaccines, has been publicly funded, which means that it is taxpayer money. So for us, there's a limit to which we can, anyone, this applies globally, not just to the region, anyone can be expected to pay twice for medicines, for vaccines, etc. It's not a rational ask at the best of times, but it is especially not rational now when so many people are suffering and dying as a result of that.
And apart from that money argument, and indeed the moral argument that you've already made, has the practical epidemiological argument, I suppose, been made that, look, if people aren't vaccinated largely simultaneously across the world, the risk of variants undermining the work of vaccines becomes more and more real as time goes on?
Exactly. That's 100% right as well. No one is safe until we're all safe. No one is going to be free of this terrible pandemic until we are all free of it. You highlighted that the variants are likely to become a big player in this, and you're exactly right. In our concern is that we're basically just heading towards a new pandemic or several new pandemics of vaccine-resistant COVID-19, unless we act quickly. Essentially, now we're in a race against the variants, and that's why it is even more critical that everyone gets vaccinated globally, because otherwise we're going to lose that race and just be stuck in a cycle for the foreseeable future.
And finally, then, would you be looking for richer developed countries to hold off on vaccinating less vulnerable sectors of their population until the most vulnerable sectors of populations in the developing world have been vaccinated? So at the very least, over 75s, over 70s, or even over 60s can be targeted around the world first before younger cohorts are looked at.
Absolutely. That would really be a strong statement to make, and probably the most fair thing to do at this time is for countries who are now lucky enough to be in the position that they've finished vaccinating their high-risk populations and their healthcare workers. We would strongly advocate that they then share those stocks or give those stocks to COVAX to enable lower income countries and middle income countries to be able to do the same thing, so that we could achieve a sort of global standard of healthcare workers and very at-risk population groups being vaccinated, and then move forward into the lower risk population groups, again, united and globally.
Okay, Claire Waterhouse, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's it for this week's episode, and from me, Colm O'Mungine. You can contact me with any feedback on colm.omungine@rte.ie, that's colm.omungine@rte.ie, or on Twitter @Colm O'Mungine. Until next week, take care, stay safe, and thanks for listening.